Thanks. So we're expecting the health reform to transform the behavioral health field in a number of ways over the next few years. Some of those changes have already started to happen. I'm going to focus today mostly on changes to funding and coverage for behavioral health, and then to think through some of the implications for providers as well as for the field in general. I'm going to start with a reminder of why behavioral health is important, talk about some of the disparities in coverage and outcomes when you compare behavioral health to physical health conditions. One of the big key points here is that health reform really can't be successful unless it accounts for behavioral health effectively. And when we talk about the triple aim in terms of cost, quality, and patient satisfaction. Talk a little bit about some of the implications of the prevention provisions of the ACA with regards to behavioral health. And finally, talk about the future of funding. I said public, but I really mean public and private funding for behavioral health. So one of the things that we often talk about the behavioral health field or the behavioral health system, which is obviously a misnomer. It's really spread piecemeal. The authority, funding, responsibilities are spread at all levels, federal, state, and local, as well as public and private. So as we think through some of the policy decisions that are being made, some of the policy decisions to come, it's really important to focus in on who has responsibility for these decisions. The Affordable Care Act leaves a lot of leverage or flexibility to states in terms of implementing a lot of the key provisions of health reform. But even within the state, it's important to think about whether it's the state insurance commissioner, the mental health agency, the state Medicaid agency, the governor. Who are we really trying to talk to here? Who are driving these decisions? In behavioral health, as many of you in the public health field in general, we're often kind of the redheaded stepchild at the table. We're not automatically invited to these discussions, and so it's really important for us to be aware of what the timelines are for decisions, figure out how we can insert ourselves into the process, because we can't just assume that we're going to be invited. It's been really interesting to us when we talk to states about some of these decisions to see some of the connections that people really don't even know each other within the state level, and we're having to, we can facilitate that to some extent, but it really has to be driven from the ground up in terms of making those connections, making sure you're part of the agenda. Awareness of the importance of behavioral health is better today than ever. I'm really heartened to see some of the ways that people within CMS, at the state level, and broadly are starting to think about behavioral health in new ways and why it's important. But there are a lot of policymakers that still don't really understand the ways that behavioral health is driving costs as well as outcomes. For example, the National Quality Strategy is something that we're really proud of in the federal government. It's a really fantastic document, but there are not a lot of specifics for behavioral health in there the way there are for some areas like cardiology or pediatrics. Here I really want to emphasize the fact that behavioral health is part of health. We really can't separate the two. In the behavioral health field, we often talk about whether we're kind of a specialty or whether we're an integral and seamless part of health in general. Sometimes we're criticized for trying to have it both ways. But it's really important to be conscious of the fact that you really can't achieve the goals of health reform without seamlessly integrating behavioral health into a lot of these initiatives. For example, you can see that a quarter of all adult stays in community hospitals involve mental health or substance use disorder in one way or another. 24% of pediatric primary care office visits and involve behavioral health. Behavioral health, one of the most striking statistics that I've seen is the fact that people with mental health, serious mental illness, die on average 25 years earlier than people without serious mental illness. That's something that we really have to start paying more attention to. That's driven, obviously, by interactions with obesity, with tobacco, substance abuse. It's also driven by inadequate access to medical care. People with mental health and substance use conditions are often more difficult to treat due to the nature of their conditions. For example, as you can see, noncompliance with medical treatment is 3 times greater for depressed patients than it is for patients without depression. Obviously, there's very similar statistics for people with substance use disorders. People with psychotic illnesses bring a whole host of other complications to the table. So we have to think about the fact, about the ways that we're designing physical health interventions and the ways that we have to account for behavioral health conditions and complexities. People with mental health and substance use disorders are also less likely to receive preventive services like immunizations, cancer screenings, and smoking cessation. And they often receive a worse quality of care across a range of conditions. This chart there, I think, is really important to remember, and when we talk about costs as well, you can see that, if you can read it, people with behavioral health problems cost on average 5 times more to treat for diabetes than the cost of that diabetes treatment for people without behavioral health conditions. Moving on to emergency room and hospitalization use. Again, behavioral health is a major driver of cost. As we look at these cost containment initiatives, we have to account for the ways that behavioral health is driving these costs. We see that on average, people with a serious mental illness cost about 150% more or have 150% higher utilization of emergency room and hospital services. One of the interesting initiatives that I heard about recently in this area is a guy named James Dunford in San Diego. He designed an intervention looking at emergency room use and ambulance services, and found that by identifying, he called them frequent flyers, other people have called them hot spotters, but focusing on people who are consuming large amounts of care, that he was able to contain costs significantly. I think that's a really important example. That intervention was not focused specifically on people with behavioral health conditions, but obviously, I don't have the data with me, but a very high percentage of those users have serious behavioral health conditions. And so I think that's one of the ways that we have to think about looking at approaches that integrate mental health and substance use interventions into our treatment practices. Looking a little bit, very briefly, at the Medicaid expansion and the exchange populations, there's a disproportionate number of people in these populations who have serious mental illness and substance use disorders. That bar in the middle is people with serious psychological distress. These numbers are not mutually exclusive. There's overlap among them. People with serious mental illness often have substance use disorders, etc. But the point here is that 1.2 million people in the Medicaid expansion population are projected to have a serious mental illness. 2.6 million people in the expansion population are expected to have a serious substance use disorder. Similarly, in the exchange population, we expect that about 1 million people in that have a serious mental illness, and almost 3 million people who will be eligible for exchange subsidies have a substance use disorder. I'll talk a little bit at the end, if I have time, about the implications for the workforce and what we need to start thinking about in terms of increasing our workforce and increasing capacity to address this. But we're really expecting a large uptick in the amount of services that are consumed. Karen spoke a little bit about the essential health benefits. As you're aware, these are required to be offered by all plans in the individual and small group markets starting in 2014. Among those 10 categories of essential health benefits, there is a category for mental health and substance use treatment. So everyone who gets access to these plans will have some degree of coverage for behavioral health conditions. It's important to keep in mind that this is not Cadillac coverage. Most states defaulted to the largest plan in the small group market. These are not plans that cover a broad spectrum of services and treatments. There's still going to be a lot of gaps in terms of what treatments are covered. At the same time, it's a huge improvement over the existing situation where you have lots of plans that don't cover behavioral health conditions at all. The Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act was passed in 2008. There's an interim final rule out right now to implement that act. The administration has promised a final rule on this by the end of the calendar year. I would encourage you to pay attention to that. We're hoping to have some news soon for you to provide some greater clarity on the ways that this is going that applies in a variety of situations. Right now, I'll just focus on the basics, which is that it does not, MAPIA, as we abbreviate it, does not require plans to offer coverage for mental health and substance use disorders. However, it requires that plans that do offer coverage, including, for example, the qualified health plans through the marketplaces, plans that do offer coverage have to provide that coverage at parity with, or roughly comparable to or equivalent to, the coverage that they provide for physical health conditions. This means things like copays, cost sharing, various ways of cost sharing can't be higher on the behavioral health side than it is on the physical health side. You can't have greater quantitative treatment limits, like the number of therapy visits, number of outpatient visits, etc., that are more restrictive for behavioral health than they are for physical health. And finally, non-quantitative treatment limits, things like pre-authorization or determinations of medical necessity, they can't be made in ways that are more restrictive or that are designed to be more restrictive than the non-quantitative treatment limits on the physical health side. There are a lot of challenges, even once the final rule is released, that I want to speak to briefly. First of all, it's a really difficult concept. We're really going to need your help explaining to the field what this means, how it's applied. It's really complex, and a lot of the people who are going to be affected most by it are going to have trouble understanding exactly what it means. For example, they're going to say, this parity rules out, doesn't it mean that my service, this treatment that I need, is going to be covered? No, the parity rule does not say what treatments have to be covered. It does not require an explicit scope of services that have to be offered. So interpreting this rule is going to require a lot of help from the field, both in terms of understanding what their coverage is, but also from an enforcement perspective in terms of identifying where the gaps are and where plans are not complying. That the enforcement is really going to have to be driven from the ground up in a lot of ways, and so we're going to need help from you all working with consumers to figure out what it means for them. Moving on to prevention, just for a minute. There's a similar changing incentives for payers. The preventing disease is a major theme in health reform. One impact is the development of the National Prevention Strategy, which focuses on communities, people, providers, and disparities. I'm thinking mostly about payers today. Again, incentives are changing. The ways that we're reimbursing care are changing as we develop these organizations like ACOs, Accountable Care Organizations. Incentives are changing through the development of quality measures, which will look at things like the extent to which providers are providing preventive services, holding them accountable for the outcomes of their patients as well. So in a variety of different ways, we're going to see providers start to think about prevention differently than they have in the past. One of the challenges to you in the public health field is to figure out how we can integrate these kinds of healthcare interventions that I'm talking about a lot today with the kinds of community strategies that many of you work on. How can we get providers, for example, to start being aware of the kinds of opportunities that are available in their communities? SAMHSA's starting, we're in the really early phases, but we're trying to develop a strategy to start educating providers, find ways to get providers to start thinking about what kinds of community interventions are available, how their patients can be a part of it, what it means for their patients, et cetera. I'm guessing that you're familiar with a lot of the provisions, the specific provisions in the Affordable Care Act about prevention. A few required services that we're excited about are preventive screenings for alcohol, tobacco, and depression for adults. There are also required screenings for kids for alcohol and drug use assessments and behavioral assessments for all children, depression screenings for adolescents, et cetera. We see similar requirements in Medicare and Medicaid in the ways that they are encouraging coverage. Medicaid does not necessarily require coverage for these preventive screenings that have been approved by the U.S. Preventative Task Force. However, it provides increased FMAP. The reimbursement rate that states receive for Medicaid gets a 1% bump if they do provide coverage for those services. So we expect to see most states try to take advantage of that. Moving on quickly to funding, I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this data, but SAMHSA recently released a report on behavioral health spending in the U.S. We're really excited about this. Data like this has not been available in the past. This is really new data that we're just starting to sort through, and I think it'll be useful for you all to dig in as well and find out what conclusions we can find, what are the trends, and what are the conclusions that we can draw. Obviously, mental health and substance abuse treatment is a small slice of all health spending. This has been roughly constant since the 90s, at least. You can see that substance abuse spending is a tiny fraction of behavioral health spending as compared to mental health spending. This is something we expect to see change in the future as coverage for substance use disorders increases due to the essential health benefits and the impact of MAPIA. We don't know how much that's going to shift, but we are expecting to see that pie become a little bit more evenly divided. It'll be interesting to track. The report that we released breaks down spending across a variety of different categories, payers, location, specialty field, et cetera. A few brief things I want to highlight. You can see that there's increasing coverage by Medicare and Medicaid since the 1986. You can see there's a large but shrinking amount of out-of-pocket spending for mental health. The next slide will be about substance use. You can see a rapidly shrinking degree of spending by other state and local. So the state discretionary spending on mental health. SAMHSA, a big part of our portfolio is the mental health and substance abuse block grants. I think it's important to highlight that that's only 1% of state spending on behavioral health. You can see it's a similar breakdown in a lot of ways for substance abuse, a much smaller role for Medicaid and third-party insurance. As I mentioned before, we're expecting that to change to some extent. You can see the important role of state and local government spending on substance use disorders. As we think about the role of the block grant and discretionary spending, I think it's really important to keep in mind that health insurance is not going to cover all the treatments that are needed. This is not Cadillac insurance. There are going to be lots of gaps. There's going to be a continued role for state and federal spending, discretionary spending for substance abuse and mental health treatment, and it's going to be really important for you all in the field to help us understand at the state and federal levels where are the gaps and how is this funding going to be needed. We're really going to need some in-depth analysis of how health reform is changing spending, where the gaps are, and where it needs to be shored up. The spending is really going to be under scrutiny. We're already seeing it in Congress, how they're trying to target discretionary spending for behavioral health. And so again, my call to action to you all is help us figure out what are the specific implications, how do we need to shift funding. The last thing I just want to show you is this slide for providers of treatment. I want to remind you that many providers for behavioral health have not been plugged into the insurance system in the past. The increasing role of insurance, therefore, is going to require them to change the ways that they operate. SAMHSA has a program called BH Business that we're working with a broad degree of, I believe it's over 900 different organizations around the country to provide education about how they can start adjusting the ways they operate, training and things like third-party contract negotiations, third-party billing, the role of HIT, et cetera. But your help is also going to be useful in figuring out how we need to adjust to the increasing role of insurance. Leave our website up there. There's a ton of information, the reports that I just mentioned, service descriptions, talking about what kinds of services are available for behavioral health, how to define them. They'll be useful for payers. Medicaid handbook that is like, what is the role of Medicaid for behavioral health? Everything you need to know about Medicaid, et cetera. Tons of stuff about parity as well. Thanks.
Thank you, David.